This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, with exactly 3 weeks to go now till the UK general election, the governing Conservative Party launched its manifesto today, on the same day that Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party sees its best polling so far since the election was called last month. Japan's work ethic has long been admired by many across the world, but new data published this week suggests that long hours and excessive overtime may come at the cost of a sharp fall in the country's population. So what policies can reverse the trend and prevent what some experts fear may lead to the ultimate extinction of the Japanese? New French President Emmanuel Macron has announced his new cabinet appointments, coming good on campaign pledges to create a smaller, gender-balanced cabinet. We'll be taking a look at his ambitious project to transform the French political landscape. A state of emergency has been declared in Yemen due to the severity of a cholera outbreak. The disease, which is ordinarily preventable, is affecting thousands amid an ongoing humanitarian crisis. And have you ever shared a flight with a king? Well, you may well have, and just not known it. All of that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus. But first, it's over to Jack Foster with all the latest on today's events from the UK general election campaign trail.
It was 11:40 a.m, around half an hour later than scheduled, that Theresa May took to the stage in Halifax, Yorkshire, to officially launch her manifesto for the UK general election on June 8th. Now, if you weren't a party member or one of the party's pre-selected members of the press, you'd have been hard pushed to work out the location of this event beyond Yorkshire, but given that Yorkshire covers about 4,500 square miles of England, it's safe to say that they probably weren't too keen on people knowing where this was happening. That, however, did not stop protesters from descending on Halifax anyway. Protesters gathered in Halifax this morning as Theresa May's Conservatives launched their general election manifesto. The protesters were angry at the ongoing cuts to public services by her government. The launch took place at Dean Clough, a renovated factory mill from the mid-1800s, and that location was no coincidence. The subtext was pretty overt, right in the middle of traditional Labour Party strongholds and a symbol of working-class struggle. Of course, Theresa May's opponents may have seen it another way, as many have accused her party of wishing to take Britain back a century or so in terms of workers' rights and attitudes towards poverty. Nonetheless, at around 11:40, a slightly tardy Theresa May was introduced, again, probably not coincidentally, by her Brexit secretary, David Davis.
She has a clear plan for Brexit and for a better future for our country. And she has the strength and ability needed to see that plan through. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Prime Minister, Theresa May.
Today, as we face this critical election for our country, I launch my manifesto for Britain's future. A manifesto to see us through Brexit and beyond. A plan for a stronger, fairer, more prosperous Britain. A plan to seize the opportunities ahead and to build a country that our children and grandchildren are proud to call home. It is a detailed programme for government, rooted in the hopes and aspirations of ordinary working people across the land. But it is more than that. It is a vision for Britain, a portrait of the kind of country I want this nation to be after Brexit, as we chart our own way in the world. For at this defining moment for the United Kingdom, as we embark on this momentous journey for our nation, we have a chance to step back and ask ourselves what kind of country we want to build together. I believe that our United Kingdom can emerge from this period of national change stronger, fairer, and more prosperous than ever before. I believe we can be a country that stands tall in the world and provides leadership on some of the greatest challenges of our time.
The UK Prime Minister Theresa May there, and her manifesto launched this morning, as you heard there, was heavily focused on Brexit and her argument that she is the only person with the vision to chart those particular stormy waters. It wasn't all about Brexit, but it's safe to say that Brexit underlined most of what she said, that and the need for strong and stable leadership, and a slightly more muted than normal dig at her opponents, opting to describe them as tribal, as opposed to the usual accusations of chaos.
The next 5 years will be among the most challenging in our lifetime, a defining period for our nation, a turning point for Britain that will determine the kind of country we are and the kind of future the generations that come after us will see. That is why now, more than ever, Britain needs strong and stable government. Why now, more than ever, Britain needs strong leadership to make the most of the opportunities Brexit will bring. Now, more than ever, Britain needs a clear plan and the determination and the will to see it through. And it is why, in this election, more than in any before, it is time to put the old tribal politics behind us and to come together in the national interest, united in our desire to make a success of Brexit, united in our desire to get the right result for Britain, because every vote for me and my team in this election will strengthen my hand in the negotiations to come.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking in Halifax this morning. Now, maybe it's just me, but something seemed awfully familiar about all of that.
Strength through unity, unity through faith. I'm a God-fearing Englishman and I'm God. Damn proud of it.
No, that wasn't a member of Theresa May's cabinet. That was the fictional TV host Lewis Prothero from the film V for Vendetta. But I digress.
A stronger, fairer, more prosperous Britain that works for everyone, not just a privileged few. That is the goal. That is the plan. And now is the time. So join me on this journey. Come with me as I lead Britain. Strengthen my hand as I fight for Britain and stand with me as I deliver for Britain. And with confidence in ourselves and a unity of purpose in our country, let us all go forward together.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May speaking in Halifax this morning as she launched her party's manifesto for the general election in June. To summarise its main points, a renewed pledge to cut net migration, the date on which a balanced budget can be expected, revised to 2025, and an end to the Fixed-Term Parliament Act. But then, in calling this snap election, she ignored that act anyway, so quite what the point of it was in the first place is anyone's guess. And of course, yes, strength, stability, unity, a successful Brexit, and oh yes, the Scottish Parliament will be forbidden from holding any referendums on independence until at least after the UK leaves Europe. So, all in all, a good day for the Tories. Well, in a way, if nothing else, because their manifesto launch will have dominated media coverage to the extent that today's YouGov poll, which was commissioned by the Times newspaper, will be pretty much buried in the news. On the face of it, of course, that poll is still pretty good news for Theresa May, who still enjoys a commanding lead. Even though she's down by 1 point, she's still ahead of Jeremy Corbyn by 13 points. But, and anyone who's been following the polls will know, that's a fair narrowing of support, the closest yet in this campaign. The poll puts Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party at 32%. And to put that in perspective, the same pollster, YouGov, had Labour on just 24% when the election was first announced. And so Labour will likely be buoyed by this new poll, which makes the possibility of a historically embarrassing defeat for Jeremy Corbyn look a little less likely than perhaps it once did. Momentum might well be building behind Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, but Labour's popularity in Scotland is about as stagnant as it has been for the past couple of years. As well as the Conservatives, Labour is diametrically opposed to the Scottish National Party on the issue specifically of independence, and the party finds itself therefore battling on two different fronts in Scotland. Let's just briefly listen to the party's Scottish leader Kezia Dugdale speaking in advance of the recent local elections.
I've been very clear to say to people who are considering voting Conservative because they're opposed to a second independence referendum that they're not voting for somebody to be in opposition. They're voting for the Tories to be in charge of their local schools and their council services. Is that really what people want? With Labour, you can vote against an independence referendum, but you can also vote for high-quality public services. Every single Labour candidate is a champion for their own local community. What you get from the SNP is a champion for independence.
That's the UK Labour Party's leader in Scotland, Kezia Dugdale, talking before the recent local elections. Now, the important thing to take from all that is that the party had said that they would not enter into any coalition deals with the Conservatives in any local councils. Not explicitly, but fairly strongly all the same. But when the Scottish National Party won the most seats in Aberdeen City Council a couple of weeks ago, the local Labour Party did just that, coming together with the Conservatives to form a majority which would outvote the SNP. Now, normally this would probably slide, but in the middle of a general election campaign, well, not so much. All 9 Labour councillors have been suspended from the party over the decision. A bold move on the part of Scottish Labour? Well, perhaps. The coalition still stands, and it's not as though those 9 councillors are allied to any other party when push comes to shove. Once the dust has settled on the June election, who can say if the party will have a change of heart? Only time will tell on that. And so, 21 days to go now, 3 weeks till the UK general election. Manifestos are out, the terms have been set, all that remains now is that final 3 weeks of campaigning. By any prediction right now, Theresa May remains on course for a comfortable victory, but polls are narrowing and the trend so far points to ever-increasing support for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. The question, though, is whether or not the momentum is moving fast enough to make any notable difference come polling day. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And of course, Jack Foster joins me in the studio now to discuss all of this a little bit further. Hello, Jack. Now, let's take a closer look at that Conservative Party manifesto, Jack. What is inside it?
You've been waiting for this all day, Karen. She's been trying to talk to me and I've had my head buried in that little blue book that you saw Theresa May waving around at the press conference this morning. Well, let's go through it piece by piece and we're just going to look at the highlights. I'm not going to read the entire thing. It's 88 pages long.
And it would be grateful if you didn't read the entire thing, Jack.
I think some of that's like an introduction and an index and things, so it's, you know, probably not 88 in full. Anyway, I better get down to this because we don't have that much time. On the NHS, no one with less than £100,000 in assets will have to pay for care. The current rate at the moment is £23,250. The major sort of health thing that she was announcing was the first new mental health bill for 35 years, which looks to put parity of esteem with physical health at its heart. Mental health will be included in first aid and in general training for 1 million people. 10,000 mental health professionals will be recruited. On tax, on the economy, money, the deficit will be wiped out by the, quote, the middle of next decade. Now, of course, anyone with long memories will remember that that is a full 10 years later than George Osborne originally promised back before they came into power in 2010. Corporation tax will fall to 17%, which is one of the lowest rates anywhere in the OECD, as the Tories have been saying they're going to do for a while, and that's obviously a very conservative policy, no great surprises on that one. Tax advisory firms that aid avoidance are set to face tougher regulation. Quite what that regulation is, quite how tough it is, we don't really know. That's that's all we have to go on that one. Now, there's a fair few other things. I'm going to just skip through, though, to workers' rights. People can take up to a year's leave to care for a family member. Now, that is unpaid leave, and obviously the criticism of that is, well, hang on a minute, this is truly just saving on actually paying people to do that who are qualified for that kind of thing. Workers will be represented on company boards, but of course those workers could actually just be an existing non-executive director. So again, sounds good in the headline. Now, Brexit was the main thing. Now, no deal is better than a bad deal. We knew that before already, so we're leaving the EU regardless.
Does it say Brexit means Brexit anywhere?
It may as well. One interesting one is the common travel area will be maintained. Now, exactly how that will work is still complicated because, of course, that affects Ireland and Northern Ireland. The common travel area means that people can travel around and out, not just Ireland, there's the other islands that are connected to the UK as well. But if that is maintained, obviously the question is that if the Republic of Ireland is still part of Europe, then surely that means that the UK has an open land border with Europe, which I suspect a lot of Brexiters would not be too happy about. Which brings us on just finally to immigration. Net immigration is supposed to be cut to below 100,000 a year. This is a target that the Conservatives have been trying to meet for a long time and haven't met. And a lot of people actually in the party have said they want it ditched because it just hasn't worked and doesn't look like it's going to. And students will be kept in net migration figures as well, despite any pleas to take them out. And they will work to reduce asylum claims, which obviously, again, a lot of controversy about that one. They're not going to commit to take more of them. One last thing under the arts, media, sport banner. The second part of the Leveson inquiry will not now go ahead.
And of course, the Leveson inquiry was what, Jack? Because the inquiry into...
This was into the News of the World and phone tapping and so
phone
on.
Phone tapping.
Which happened a few years ago.
It was a very controversial inquiry, and it is that's quite a big deal that they have now said that that will not go ahead.
Well, a lot of people will be speculating that that might be significant in terms of the Conservative government's ties, perhaps, to the Rupert Murdoch media empire.
Now, as you mentioned in that report, the Labour Party are doing quite well in the polls today. And how is that affecting the campaign narrative?
Well, oddly, it's not really affecting it at all. If you've been watching news coverage today of the UK election, if you've been reading about it, it's actually not something that's come up at all. Because, of course, as I mentioned in the report there, it's happened on the same day that the Conservatives launched their manifesto. Now, of course, Theresa May couldn't possibly have known that in advance. I'm not saying there was some conspiracy that she was holding it on the same day that Jeremy Corbyn suddenly had his best polling result. But obviously, it's unfortunate because had this fallen on a quieter news day, then maybe there would have been a bit more momentum in the news for Jeremy Corbyn. But from the Conservatives' perspective, that will be just the perfect timing and the icing on the cake for the manifesto launch today, that it will have completely buried that story.
And now, what about the story of the Labour councillors in Aberdeen being expelled from the party? Now, Labour is already not doing very well in Scotland. Doesn't the loss of 9 councillors inflict yet more damage on them?
Well, it could do, but you have to look at this in two ways. First of all, yes, they have lost 9 councillors, but of course those 9 councillors will still be loyal to the Labour Party. They are Labour councillors, after all. And we have to look at this in terms as well of tactics. This is very much a tactical move on the part of Scottish Labour. Scottish Labour are stuck in a very difficult situation where in Scotland they are vehemently opposed to the Conservative Party, as they are across the UK, but they are also vehemently opposed to the Scottish National Party. Now, officially speaking, that they are equally opposed to both of them. I think a lot of people in Scotland would probably suspect that they are more opposed to the Scottish National Party due to the independence cause. And as we know, Labour did work alongside the Conservative Party, as well as Liberal Democrats and other unionist parties back in 2014 during the Scottish independence referendum. And they came under a lot of controversy for that. And indeed, many have said that that is why they have lost so much support in Scotland. So they said before the council elections that they wouldn't go into coalitions with Conservatives. It wasn't like a pledge, a promise or anything, but they said they wouldn't do it, and then Aberdeen did it. Aberdeen actually has form on, the Labour group in Aberdeen have form on doing things that sound, on the face of it, a little bit crazy, one might say, towards the Scottish National Party. If you remember back during the Scottish independence referendum of 2014, the Aberdeen Labour councillors banned Alex Salmond, who at the time was the First Minister of Scotland, from any council building. Now, I'm not sure how the ban actually panned out, but that was a thing that they did. It's fair to say that they don't like the SNP, so going into coalition with the Conservatives was to keep the SNP out, because, of course, the important thing to remember is that they did win the most seats.
And the Conservative councillors in Aberdeen are now celebrating that it's a unionist council that will be leading the council there, in very much bringing the constitutional question to local politics, which they're getting quite a bit of criticism for from pro-independence supporters.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, that's the thing in Scotland. I mean, obviously, international listeners, this would be sort of sound crazy. Who knows what's going on in Scotland? But the thing about Scottish politics now is that it's become very strange. The Scottish National Party have for years campaigned for independence, and obviously there was a referendum which was a no vote in 2014. But since then, oddly, what has happened is that a divide has grown in Scottish politics whereby the Scottish National Party actually doesn't talk that much about independence. It wants to have another referendum, but it's not the sort of central plank of what they're talking about, whereas the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, and to a much lesser extent the Liberal Democrats, it is the central plank of all of their campaigning. And as you say, in council elections, which have nothing whatsoever to do with the Constitution and have no effect on it, the campaigning message from the Conservatives and the Labour Party was, we don't want another referendum on independence. It's divisive. It's awful. We don't want independence. Vote for us if you don't want independence.
Well, Jack, I fear that you and I could probably talk about this all day long, but we don't have time to. So thank you very much, Jack Foster.
See what happens.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, Japan's work ethic has long been admired by many across the world, but new data published this week suggests that long hours and excessive overtime may come at the cost of a sharp fall in the country's population. So what policies can reverse this trend and prevent what some experts fear may lead to the ultimate extinction of the Japanese? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
From June 1st to June 3rd, political leaders, top experts, and prominent businessmen from all across the globe are meeting at St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. Join them in discussion on relevant topics concerning new economic reality, geopolitics to cybersecurity. Roughly 100 business events, roundtables and discussions, business breakfasts, and insightful lectures, all this and more at SPIEF 2017. Don't miss out. More details on forumsbb.com.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Japan's work ethic has long been admired by many across the world, but new research published this week suggests that long hours and excessive overtime may come at the cost of a sharp fall in the country's population. So what policies can reverse the trend and prevent what some experts fear may lead to the ultimate extinction of the Japanese? New French President Emmanuel Macron has announced his new cabinet appointments, coming good on campaign pledges to create a smaller, gender-balanced cabinet. We'll be taking a look at his ambitious project to transform the French political landscape. And have you ever shared a flight with a king? Well, you might well have and just not known it. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 23 minutes past the hour. Japan is world-renowned for its strong work ethic and committed labour force, but new research suggests that outlook may come with a high price for Japanese society and the future of the country, as fertility levels continue to plummet. Our reporter Mark Kurtz had been taking a look at what this might mean for the future of the country.
It's a societal tsunami that could have a devastating impact on Japan's population. New data suggests that unless the Japanese fertility rate is significantly reversed, the country's current population will fall by 40 million people from its current level of 127 million by 2065. Statistics from Japan's National Institute of Population and Social Security Research has shown that less than 1 million babies were born in Japan in 2016, the lowest birth rate since 1899. Experts are pointing to a reluctance by younger Japanese to start a family, and the country also suffers from low immigration rates. But a big factor is the deep ingrained work ethic, an inherent part of Japanese culture and society. More women entering the labour market in a country where traditionally the men went to work and the women stayed at home raising the children is compounding the issue. Some are even warning that it's the end of the family in Japan. Japan is not alone in terms of declining fertility levels. The US, Denmark, China and Singapore are all experiencing similar trends of declining fertility, although Japan's is far more steep than any other country in the world. Compounding the situation even further is the rapid rise in the number of older Japanese over the age of 65 as a percentage of the total population. At present, they make up just 27% of the population. But by 2060, that figure will be 40% of the entire population, placing additional pressures on the younger generations, possibly discouraging them even further from having a family. To explore this issue further, I spoke earlier with Stuart Geetel-Baston, Professor in Social Policy at the University of Oxford. Professor Baston, the Japanese are known for their extremely strong work ethic, but does this new data prove that that ethic comes with a high price in terms of fertility levels, and are there other multiple factors at work here?
I think that's absolutely right. The problem is that Japanese society, actually in common with many other societies in East Asia, has been extremely successful in efficiency, productivity, rapid growth over the last 30 or 40 years, but it's almost as if that's kind of too romantic. The human component, the softer side of life, about forming relationships, getting a house together, dating, having children, that seems to have kind of been forgotten about. It's not been written into the economic equation, and now we're starting to see that kind of coming home to roost with these very low fertility rates across the region for quite some time now. So I think that the work ethic really is very, very central to this broader problem at the moment.
And Japan isn't the only country facing a drop in fertility levels. How much of an influence has the growth of technology played in changing how people in mostly Western societies communicate and interact with each other? And is there any way to reverse that trend?
Well, in terms of reversing the trend, very, very, very few countries in the world have been able to turn around fertility rates through their own policies, through policy intervention. While fertility has gone up in some countries after policies have been introduced, it's been very difficult to directly tie that to a change in policy. And of course, in many countries now where fertility is very low, the state historically has not been very active. And that's particularly that kind of compounds the problem in East Asia, where in places like Taiwan or Hong Kong or Singapore, which have been based upon the state playing a limited role of low tax. Of course, then it's very difficult for the state to all of a sudden be this big actor or big agent in designing policy. So it's a real problem, actually.
And the other big problem facing Japan is a very steady growth in the number of older people within its overall population. That's eventually going to place an even greater burden on younger Japanese who are going to be expected to care and look after them. What evidence is there that social policymakers in Japan understand the dangers posed by this societal tsunami, if you like, that appears to be on the horizon?
Well, I think it's perceived to be the greatest demographic challenge of the 21st century for policymakers over there. They really are quite frightened of this silver tsunami, as it's, I think, quite called, and it's considered to be a real concern, both in terms of the burden on the state, and also for individuals. But of course, it's not just about population aging, but of course, it's population decline. Japan, in particular, is forecast to see quite rapid population decline continuing over the next 2 years, which has already begun in Japan, but is going to be forecast to occur in very big numbers in China and elsewhere. So that's not just about the economy, but it's also about the sense of identity, the sense of the nation, the sense of the state. And of course, one curious thing, which all of these countries are grappling with at the moment, is related to immigration. Europe, while it has European countries, North America, most post-industrial countries have fertility rates, which is such that the country will not replace itself. But population decline is quite low and population ageing is low because we have immigration. But of course, in Japan, for example, and certainly to China, net immigration is almost zero. And that's related to kind of cultural attitude around immigration. And that gives you just as I think it's quite pertinent in the election at the moment and the way that migration is thought of in Europe as this kind of as a dirty word, as a bad thing. But it's that example from East Asia that it shows the extreme of that actually, if you don't have migration, if you don't have a managed immigration system, then actually, you know, you'll find yourself maybe solving one problem, you know, like a kind of concern, you know, but you actually create a new demographic problem, which is actually much more difficult to solve in the long run.
Do the policies that the Japanese government have enacted, such as encouraging people to have a greater work-life balance and urging businesses to offer shorter working hours for their employees, do they go far enough in trying to address this issue?
Well, no, because the problem is that the take-up of these policies is very low. Because there needs to be a whole-scale reform in working culture, and that's going to be much more difficult to implement. Yes, I mean, in Japan and Korea, you see lots of these great policies about family being more family-friendly and allowing men and women to take more time off. But actually, the number of people who take these up are quite low. And part of the reason for that is because of the fragility of the labour force. It's very difficult to get a decent job, and it's also your workers' rights are quite low, so it's very easy for you to be kicked out because somebody else could very easily come in and take your job. So it's really a kind of a cultural mindset which needs to be changed, and not just a few policies.
How closely are other countries that are likewise facing a marked drop in fertility levels watching what is happening in Japan to determine whether lessons can be learned and applied before they reach a crisis point?
Everybody, particularly in the region, is looking at Japan and seeing this as where this might go. And of course, let's not forget there's plenty of other reasons why the Japanese economy is slowing down. It's not just related to the aging society. And so Japan is a little bit of an outlier in that sense. But you see across the region a kind of concern. But the difficulty is, and the reason why as a demographer it gets a bit frustrating, because it's a very slow burning issue. You know, we're talking about having to plan for not just the electoral cycle of 5 years or so, but for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in the future. And of course, that requires pretty painful political decisions to be taken now with regard to pensions or retirement or whatever it might be. But you're not going to reap the benefits of that for 20 or 30 years. And it takes a very brave politician indeed to stick his or her neck above the parapet and make some very unpopular decisions about what's going to happen in 20 or 30 years' time when they're not going to be in power. And we see that in Britain as well as we see it in Europe, as well as seeing that in Asia as well.
And finally, on a wider global level, as the planet's human population continues to grow, placing additional pressures on the limited resources that are there, might a significant drop in fertility levels in some parts of the world ultimately prove a good thing in terms of managing those resources?
It's not quite as straightforward as that, unfortunately. Firstly, we know that it's not just the number of people which are important to climate change or resource use or whatever it is, but how they use the resources and how they live their lives, you know. So that's why you have tiny little places like Qatar will have the same total emissions output as huge great big places like the Central African Republic, you know. So it's not just about numbers, it's about behaviour. And of course, the biggest challenge we face is that in countries at the moment with very high fertility, we see that if their fertility falls in the future, there will indeed be fewer people. But the mechanisms by which fertility will fall will be through things like urbanisation, will be through increased consumption, will be through industrialisation. All of these things increase emissions. So you're very likely to see, yes, lower fertility, fewer people, but almost by definition, their carbon footprint will likely increase. So it's not really a kind of, it's not that balancing act of fewer population, less destruction or better for the environment doesn't quite work like that. I mean, ultimately, of course, the optimal population of human beings for the environment is zero. But, you know, that's quite a bleak. Although, in fact, although the Koreans and the Japanese are forecasting when Korea and Japan will go extinct, that's quite a bleak, long-run future that we don't have to worry about for a couple of thousand years. So we should be okay.
Well, that's a relief to know. Professor Baston, thanks very much. A fascinating insight there. And thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
Thank you ever so much.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
You are listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. The French President Emmanuel Macron has announced his new cabinet, taking the next step in his project to transform the French political landscape. Macron has blurred party lines, drawing in political figures from the left and the right, and members of civil society, and has made good on his campaign pledge to create a smaller, gender-balanced cabinet. He has faced criticism from the left and the right, but could this balanced cabinet help Macron secure a majority for his young party En Marche at next month's legislative elections? Well, earlier today I spoke to Professor James Shields, Professor of French Politics and Modern History at Aston University, and began by asking him just why Macron had gone about creating such a cabinet.
Macron is trying to redefine the political landscape in France, an ambitious project. He's positioned himself right in the centre, claiming to be what he calls both left and right. And from there, he's trying to bring about a recomposition of French politics. How does he do that? By breaking up the old parties that have governed France more or less throughout the entirety of the Fifth Republic, the centre-right descendants of the Gaullists and the centre-left socialists. It's clear that the French are fed up with the monopoly on power that's been exercised by these two big currents. Neither of their candidates made it to the second round of the recent election, which saw Macron as an independent centrist face Marine Le Pen of the far right. Now Macron has been elected on a promise of political renewal. And the way to do that, he thinks, is to kill off the old monolithic parties of right and left, break them and draw their moderate wings towards a new political point of gravity in the centre around him.
Is it likely to be the transformation of politics that Macron hopes for, or could this not result in divisions within his own cabinet?
Yes, and that's part of the risk that he runs, because he has put together, he's a very composite cabinet. He's got half a dozen socialists and left radicals. He's got three centrists. He's got three Republican conservatives. And most innovatively, he's got 11 members of civil society who are not politicians that he's brought in to government posts. So it's a real mix of political position and political experience. We've seen a bit of that in the past in French politics. We've seen other governments that have included the odd expert from outside politics. But Macron has really gone for it in a serious way here. So there are risks in putting this sort of assembly together. The other thing we can see already is this. On the socialist left, they're calling it a right-wing government. On the conservative Republicans' right, they're calling it a left-wing government. So in that sense, Macron has achieved his purpose. He has put together a government that is both of the right and of the left. Now we have to see how well it works.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that some of those criticisms from the left and the right will be being made with a look to future elections. And this could really have an impact on the real identity of left-wing and right-wing parties in years to come, couldn't it?
Yes, that's the whole project that Macron has embarked on. He sees that politics throughout the Fifth Republic has been dominated by this alternation of power between centre-right and centre-left. And the French are in a moment right now of disaffection, alienation from politics. They don't want that anymore. So what Macron is setting out to do is to redraw the landscape, to break up the Socialist Party, to let its more radical elements drift to the far left and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, but to draw its more moderate elements to him. And he's got the same intentions for the Republican Conservatives, to let the more radical elements, if they want to, go towards Marine Le Pen and the Front National and draw the more moderate elements to him. So that in a sense, we could end up with a French political landscape that would look like this. A powerful far right under Marine Le Pen, a powerful far left under Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and a more powerful and more voluminous, if you like, extended centre under Emmanuel Macron.
But looking at the actual appointments that he's made here, now, what would you say is the most striking appointment in his cabinet?
Well, each appointment is significant in its own way, but I'd point to two. The appointments of Republican Conservatives Bruno Le Maire and Gérald Darmanin as Economy Minister and Public Accounts Minister. Macron has found it easy to attract defectors from the socialist left, but much harder to dislodge elements of the Republican Conservatives. And these two appointments of Le Maire and Darmanin send a strong signal to the Republicans that Macron is serious about his number one priority, and that is reforming the labour laws, injecting more flexibility into the economy and bringing down unemployment. These were priorities at the top of Conservative candidate François Fillon's programme in the recent election. And the appointment of Le Maire and Darmanin now will also be taken, it should be said, as a strong signal by the unions in France, who are mobilising already for a day of action in June. And in these uncertain times, the one sure thing is that a clash between President Macron and the unions is not far off, especially if he tries, as he said he will, to reform the labour laws by decree.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there are the elections, the legislative elections in June, and as you mentioned a moment ago, Macron seems to be creating this centrist movement here. Could this in itself play into Macron's hand with regards to those elections in June, in that he is showing that he's listening to people from across the political spectrum, therefore trying to kind of attract as many votes as possible for En Marche?
That's his gamble. That's his gamble, and we don't know yet whether it will come off. The biggest challenge that lies ahead for Macron will be securing a governing majority for his fledgling party in those elections next month to the National Assembly. Macron needs that majority if he's to be a fully functioning president. What he can't afford is to fall well short of a majority and be drawn into what the French call cohabitation with a hostile political bloc of conservative Republicans, since they are the most likely to form the biggest bloc to rival Macron's party. That would put governing the country in the hands of his Republican opponents and would reduce him to a role as a kind of moderator rather than an initiator of policy. So all eyes are going to be on those elections of 11th and 18th June to know what sort of president Macron's going to be allowed to be.
Mm-hmm. And of course, looking at what sort of president Macron seems to want to be, this week Macron also met with Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, to begin talks on his ambitious European policy. And Macron seems to be keen to be seen as this top diplomat. And from media reports and from reactions within the European Parliament this week, he seems to be gaining a lot of respect. Is he perhaps setting the bar a little bit high for himself? Can he live up to the expectations that he's created here?
He has set the bar high, that's right, he has. And it's noticeable, again, if we just look at the appointments that have been made to the new government, the former defence minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, has been named not as Minister of Foreign Affairs, which would be normal, but he's been named Minister for Europe and Foreign Affairs. And that's another Macron priority, to strengthen the Franco-German axis and put France back at the heart of building the EU. And Macron wants a lot more EU, though he also wants to reform it and to make it work better. His first trip abroad was to meet Angela Merkel. He celebrated his victory to the strains of the EU anthem, Ode to Joy. And He fought an energetically pro-European campaign, arguing for further and deeper EU integration among a field of candidates where Euroscepticism and Euro-hostility were prominent. So his first priority is France, his next priority is the EU, and then and only then do we get to wider foreign affairs issues.
Well, Professor Shields, as always, it's an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for joining us today on World in Focus.
It's my pleasure, as always.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, a state of emergency has been declared in Yemen due to the severity of a cholera outbreak. The disease, which is ordinarily preventable, is affecting thousands amid an ongoing humanitarian crisis. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
All right, we'll do one together. You ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Into Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they send me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, a state of emergency has been declared in Yemen due to the severity of a cholera outbreak. The disease, which is ordinarily preventable, is affecting thousands amid an ongoing humanitarian crisis. And have you ever shared a flight with a king? Well, you may well have and just not known it. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the Arab world and has been in a political crisis since 2011. In 2015, Saudi Arabia led a military intervention against the Houthi rebels, giving their backing to the internationally recognised but domestically opposed government of Yemen's president Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi. This conflict continues today and has devastated the country. The Saudi-led coalition has faced intense scrutiny for indiscriminate bombing and the use of cluster munitions, resulting in high numbers of civilian casualties. Since 2015, over 7,000 people have been killed in the conflict and over 40,000 injured. But the conflict has also triggered a major humanitarian disaster, leaving 70% of the population in need of aid. Alongside widespread famine and poverty, on Monday, officials declared a state of emergency in Yemen due to the severity of a cholera outbreak, which has taken hundreds of lives and left thousands in need of medical help. The current outbreak of what would ordinarily be an entirely treatable and preventable disease began in late April. By early May, the World Health Organization said that 2,300 cases of cholera had been recorded in the current outbreak. By Tuesday, May 16th, the World Health Organization estimated that 14,000 people had become infected. Those figures are climbing every day. According to the UK charity Oxfam, cholera first broke out in Yemen in October 2016, and before the current upsurge, there had already been over 27,000 suspected cases of cholera, including 116 deaths. Much of Yemen's infrastructure has been decimated by the ongoing conflict. The health system is crippled, and it is estimated that only 45% of health facilities are functioning. There have been numerous reports this week of hospital corridors lined with people, some even sitting in cars outside hospitals with IV drips. Piles of rubbish line the streets of the capital Sana'a, with sanitation workers on strike due to weeks of unpaid wages. Earlier today, I spoke to Dina El Mamoun, the Yemen head of policy and advocacy for Oxfam, and spoke to her about the circumstances in Yemen that led to cholera becoming a much more dangerous and deadly disease, given that, with the correct resources, cholera is ordinarily a treatable disease with a lower than 1% mortality rate.
Over, you know, the last 2 years, we have seen a situation in Yemen where people are suffering because of the conflict, the shelling, the airstrikes, malnutrition, and also price increases and, you know, reaching up to 40%, no salaries. These are all huge problems, have been going on for some time. And consequently, it is not really that surprising that the population is weak, lacks the resilience and the physical and mental resistance to be able to actually fight diseases and get up and, you know, after facing all these difficulties. So in that sense, yes, we have seen the cholera, when it has taken hold, it has such a devastating impact. The numbers are increasing all the time. It's not the first time that we've seen cholera. So this is, you know, a protracted issue linked to the conflict, linked to the situation on the ground. And in that sense, in addition to all of this, what we are also seeing is a humanitarian response that is not fully funded. So in a way, international organizations need the support that is necessary in order to put in place some sort of response that is adequate to the disaster we are seeing in Yemen. And it is a shame on the world community that only 18% of pledged funds have been met. And even those pledged funds are only 50% of what is needed. So no wonder that all of this together is impacting in a way that makes people suffer and for cholera to take such a halt.
Mm-hmm. And of course, fighting has decimated much of the country's infrastructure, including, importantly, its medical facilities. And the World Health Organization said earlier this year that fewer than half of Yemen's medical centres were functioning to capacity. Medecins Sans Frontières had to withdraw from several locations last year as their hospitals were being targeted by the Saudi-led coalition. So even if the funds and the medicines and supplies were available, how difficult is it to actually deliver and supply aid, given the dangers that humanitarian workers are facing in Yemen?
Well, obviously, I mean, the difficulty in the infrastructure and the health facilities and the functioning of the health facilities is an issue. And that is why, you know, at the moment people are reporting, you know, how people are in the corridors of hospitals, that patients are being looked after by their relatives rather than, you know, and then this also links to the issue of non-payment of salaries. You know, for example, the cleaners have not been paid their salaries. So obviously, you know, the issue of hygiene is quite important, and then also medical staff and therefore their ability to then respond. But if international organizations are given at least the adequate support, we can try to see how we can resolve the issue, how we can come up with solutions to the issue around the infrastructure, around, you know, the functionality of medical facilities. But definitely this is something that has had even a worse impact on the situation.
Mm-hmm. And for the families of those who are suffering right now, I mean, Oxfam has highlighted some reports of the desperation they're going through. The appeal on the Oxfam website mentions a retired soldier who said his youngest son was weakened in hospital and he himself considered selling his own kidney to try to get help prior to receiving international aid. Now, this example, this desperation isn't unique, is it? This isn't a one-off case.
Not at all. This is not a one-off case. Also, people, you know, on their deathbeds wanting to see their family relatives, but they are too scared that their family, some of their children, for example, would come to the hospital and then pick up the disease as well. Also, what we've been told is different hospitals. It's not just one or two hospitals. It's hospitals across the city. So where do you go as well? It's really not isolated cases by any means.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dina, thank you very much for joining us today. It's great to have you on and highlight this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Dina El-Mamoun, Yemen's Head of Policy and Advocacy for Oxfam. Finally, if you've ever flown with the Dutch airline KLM, you may well have been in the company of royalty without ever knowing it. Apparently, for many years, the Dutch monarch King Willem-Alexander has been secretly co-piloting flights for the airline's Cityhopper services. He told the newspaper De Telegraaf that he finds flying simply fantastic, saying, quote, "You can't take your problems from the ground into the skies. You can completely disengage and concentrate on something else," end quote. He said that he was rarely recognised, in part due to tight security that limited his interaction with the public, and also due to his official uniform and cap. And apparently he intends to carry on flying with the airline as a regular guest pilot and will spend the next few months being retrained to fly Boeing 737s. And that's all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
From June 1st to June 3rd, state officials and decision makers from top Russian and global companies are gathering in St. Petersburg for a one-of-a-kind event. St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017 is set to welcome over 12,000 participants from 133 countries. It featured discussions on most pressing issues of today, all under the aegis of its core theme, achieving a new balance on the global stage. Top government figures and leading experts from all around the world are meeting at the biggest platform for international discussion. For more details, head to www.forumsbb.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.